Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say we have Dave Shearer on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Policing Stalin's Socialism, Repression and Social Order in the Soviet Union, 1924 to 1953. When I was an undergraduate many, many years ago and was studying the Great Terror, as it was then called, we read, if I recall correctly, Roy Medvedev's Let History Judge. We read a memoir or two, probably Into the Whirlwind by Evgeny Ginzburg. We may have read Robert Conquest's Great Terror. I don't have a clear recollection of these things, but this much I do know, having read Dave Shearer's book, we have learned a lot since then, because the picture of the Great Purges, as Dave calls it, that emerges from Policing Stalin's Socialism is very different from the one that is presented in those, what should now be seen as early attempts to understand the mass killings in the Soviet Union in the period 1937 to 38. Dave has scoured all the archives, and he has discovered some quite remarkable things about the origins of the Great Purges, things that will turn much of the received historiography on its head. I really enjoyed talking to Dave today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Dave.
Hello, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm doing fine, surviving the last week of the semester.
Yeah, well, you and me both. I should tell our listeners that we're talking to Dave Shearer today, and we'll be discussing his terrific new book, Policing Stalin's Socialism, Repression and Social Order in the Soviet Union, 1924 to 1953. This was a really eye-opening book for me to read. I've read a lot of books about Stalinist repression in the 1920s and 1930s. And this one, unlike many of them I have read, actually has something quite new to say. We'll talk about that in the course of the interview, and I think that all of the listeners will find it very enlightening. But Dave, why don't we begin the interview by having you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a Soviet historian. I'm at the University of Delaware in the history department. I originally went to Ohio State for my undergraduate work. I did a master's degree there, and then I went to the University of Pennsylvania and studied under Moshe Levin, took a PhD in 1988, and then had some postdocs, and then ended up here at the University of Delaware, which is where I've been since. So
we have a lot of
it's
Buckeyes.
Actually been kind of a gem of a place to be.
Yeah, I'm sure. I was going to say we have a lot of Buckeyes who've been on this show. It's quite remarkable. And also Moshe, you know, I don't know if most people would know who Moshe Lewin is, but he was very important in your field. Maybe you could say a few words about him, because he's just passed, hasn't he?
Yes, he died last August in Paris, which I guess was his real home. He was a preeminent social historian, had grown up in Vilnius in between the war. And then when the war started, he evacuated into the Soviet Union, ended up as an officer in the Soviet Army. Then he smuggled himself out of the Soviet Union through Poland, Czechoslovakia, ended up in France, Israel. Eventually did his PhD at the Sorbonne under Ferdinand Braudel, and then began an academic career in Britain, and eventually moved in the mid-1970s to the United States. And as I say, he was one of the pioneers of social history, I would say, of the Soviet period. And he had a long, distinguished career, and he finally retired, went back to Paris, in the last couple of years of his life, and that's where he died. Mm-hmm. So I was fortunate to be one of his students.
Yeah, he was. He has a reputation of being kind of tough. At least, is that true?
Yeah. Well, yes. Tough or very discriminating or something like that. Yeah. There were only a few people who actually finished under him. I would say tough, but also a very complicated man. Mm-hmm. I think actually in the journal Kritika, Al Reber, who was a longtime colleague of his, is going to have a memoriam piece that
Oh, really?
I think describes him very well. It should be coming out, I think, in this next issue.
That's That's terrific. I look forward to reading that. So let's move on to a discussion of the book. How did you come to write Policing Stalin's Socialism?
Well, I finished my first book in the mid-1990s, which was actually on, it was on the state, but it was on political economy. And the one thing I kept noticing as I was working through that material and any other material was how chaotic things were in this supposedly totalitarian state. And what got me originally interested in issues of order, things like that, were a lot of the economic crimes I came across when I was working on the first book. And so I originally was going to write a book about sort of an illegal economy or black market economy, and then it just kind of kept spreading into other directions, so that I eventually ended up coming around to the whole issue of social order, policing, political policing, and repression. So it kind of opened from a narrow door into a much wider field, I guess. It took a while, but it was worth doing.
When you started the project, it sounded like it evolved sort of organically. So I suspect I know the answer to this question.
Yeah.
When you started the project, did you think you were going to end up with a new interpretation of the Great Purges?
No. I actually was going to stay away from the Great Purges. as they call the Great Terror. I just thought, you know, I don't want to get into those arguments. But eventually, yes, I found myself that it was just inevitable. I couldn't get around it, and in fact, eventually didn't want to get around it, because I thought, the more I looked into the materials I was looking into, that there needed to be some reinterpretation of it. Mm-hmm. But originally it was going to be about social policing and not about political policing. The great surprise to me was that, in fact, the two were very closely related.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what is the difference, since you mentioned these two terms and they're important for the book, what is the difference between political policing and social policing? I don't think we have political policing in the United States, do we? Don't answer that question. There could be somebody listening. What is the difference in the Soviet context?
Well, a lot of that is historiographically constructed, which is to say that most people who write about the political police in the Soviet Union, and there was a political police, the GPU, the OGPU, and then what's sort of incorrectly called the NKVD. The NKVD also included garbage disposal, but it was the political police, the GUGB, that actually controlled the Commissariat of the Interior. That was the political police. And in the historiography, traditionally, everyone has written about, if they write about political police or political repression, they're writing about repression against what was perceived as political opposition. So, you know, running around looking for Trotskyists, underground political organizations, Polish spies, those kinds of things. Social policing or social order was generally considered to be the domain of the civil police. And that meant fighting criminality, itinerants, beggars, all the kinds of things that we think of as, and what in fact in the 1920s in the Soviet Union were called, social anomalies. And traditionally, historians who write about repression in the Soviet Union focus on what they think of as the political police and what they think of as political repression. And they don't think that the subject covers supposedly issues of social order, criminality, mass migration, those kinds of things. And what I found was that, in fact, the two were very closely linked.
Mm-hmm. And how so? And I think what you could talk about here is that the way in which the Bolsheviks, and this is a bit of a terminological muddle, I think I'll call them Bolsheviks and not communists or socialists, just Bolsheviks, the way they thought about crime, how did they see crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, that changed. And this also to me was an interesting revelation, a simple one, but also a revelation. Attitudes towards criminality changed. from the 1920s to the 1930s. In the 1920s, criminality, I mean, they always considered criminality to be an aspect of a bourgeois hangover or an aspect of capitalist societies where crime is the product of different economic, socioeconomic status, property, those kinds of things. And that within socialism, crime would eventually disappear as equality of opportunity and wealth and prosperity took over. So in the 1920s, this was during the period of NEP, the mixed capitalist socialist system, crime was still considered to be a social anomaly, or it was considered to be a sort of part of the capitalist compromise left over from the pre-revolutionary era. And it was the domain of the civil police. It was considered in many ways the way, and it was dealt with in many ways, crime was dealt with by any professional police force in other areas of Europe, according to, or considered to be what they called social anomalies. Criminals were arrested according to statutes, criminal statutes, and so on. But that changed very suddenly, and it changed in 1933 with the declaration that capitalism had been defeated with the so-called success of dekulakization, the defeat of organized capitalist resistance from peasants, so-called kulaks, from the net men, and the triumph of socialism. That created a problem because now criminality, any kind of social disorder, could not be explained as a social anomaly of capitalism. It had to be, it ideologically, it could be nothing other than anti-Soviet conscious behavior. And therefore, it became politicized. And therefore, it became the concern of the political police. And so the attitude toward criminality, toward anything from beggars to criminals to people with illegal documents, was that they were suspected of being anti-Soviet because now that there was full socialism there, it couldn't be explained any other way. So now, these were enemies of the state.
And how did that change how they were dealt with, or did it change how they were dealt with? And the reason I ask that question is I can imagine being a civil police officer and then being told that, you know, this kind of ragamuffin who hangs out on Red Square and is known to have been a pickpocket, well, he's now an enemy of the state.
Yeah.
What are you supposed to do with that information?
Yeah. Well, now, as I said, as beginning in 1933, and very specifically in January of 1933, the regime's officials, and Stalin chief among them, defined social disorder as the new and most dangerous form of class war. Now that organized class opposition had been defeated. And in fact, he described theft of property, which is now socialist property, and criminality as more dangerous than any other threat to the stability of the state in the task of building socialism. That redefinition of criminality and social disorder as class war made social order a matter of state security and therefore a prime concern of the political police. As a result of that, one of the central tasks of the political, as well as the civil police, then for much of the 1930s, focused on administrative repression of these so-called anti-Soviet elements rather than repression of political opposition. So the political police under Stalin became increasingly drawn into the realm of social governance, while the civil police on the other side became militarized as an extension of the state's political policing organs. And what that meant specifically was that, contrary to the way the civil and political police had been separated in the 1920s, beginning in late 1930, the political police began to take over the operational and then the administrative functioning of the civil police, the militia. This was first done through secret protocols that were not made public until 1932, But in 1932 and 1933, the political police took over the civil police became officially, formally subordinated to the political police. And the political police then attempted to restructure the civil police so that the administrative structures and the operational structures would fit into the operational and administrative system of the political police and work as an extension of the political police. When this happened, there were civilian police officials, but high officials who said that this should not happen, that the civil police should not be militarized, that this should not happen under socialism. And they resisted it. They resisted it very strongly. But Stalin, of course, was very interested in having this happen. And so under Genrikh Jagoda, over the course of a number of years, the political police took over the civilian police and attempted to remake them along the line, the disciplinary lines and the operational lines of the political police. It never really worked. but structurally and formally, this is what happened. In terms of ordinary policemen, what did they think? Well, a lot of the police that were hired in the 1930s were brought in from the political police, or they were demobilized army soldiers. And so they were quite happy to, they largely bought into this idea. If there was resistance to it at the beginning, and there was, even at the local levels, by the mid-1930s, I think Jagoda had created a policing system that accepted its function and its role within the state. Mm-hmm. But there are interesting examples in the early 1930s, especially during dekulakization, where the civilian police at local levels refused to engage in the kind of mass repression that the political police wanted them to engage in.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask two questions about the politicization of the civil police. Did it change the way in which cases were adjudicated? That's question A. And then B, did it change the penalties that were meted out? And when you're answering question A, that is about adjudication, you mentioned this distinction between administrative procedures and I guess what we call civil procedures. What is that distinction exactly?
Well, not so much civil as judicial and extrajudicial. Yeah. Or administrative and judicial. Let me answer B first, because it's okay. The easier answer first. And that is that throughout the 1930s, punishments for what we would consider to be statutory crimes, in fact, increased in severity, both judicial and administratively. What began to occur, especially even in 1932, but especially in 1933, with the beginning of the passport system, the internal documentation system, is that police administrative sentencing boards were set up that included both civilian and political police. And these had the power to arrest citizens and to sentence them for up to 5 years in either camps or colonies or some kind of exile, or simply to deport them and forbid them to live in certain areas of the country. And they could do this under administrative laws. They could do it without a trial, without the person being brought up on a criminal statute. They could do it under these kind of broad categories of laws that refer to what were called antisocial elements. Mm-hmm. So these political administrative boards, which became known as Troika, began to work in the early 1930s. And as the civil courts, since the civil courts, the judicial courts, were so packed with cases, more and more cases were simply sent to these administrative boards, so that by 1934, these civilian boards were were taking in and looking at cases that were far beyond their original jurisdiction of, say, residence violations and things like this. And in fact, they became a major way that citizens were repressed. That is to say, that were deprived of either property or freedom in some way, or restriction of movement. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in 1934, supposedly with the creation of the Commissariat of Internal Affairs, these troiki supposedly were supposed to be stopped. And the political troiki were, but one of the things that I found that was startling to me is that within several months, the administrative police boards were working again. Mm-hmm. And they worked all through the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And they essentially sentenced political as well as, or they sentenced people for up to 5 years for any number of crimes or even being in the wrong place at the wrong time without documents. Mm-hmm. So this is what I mean by administrative policing. And many of these people were caught up in these boards by mass police operations. That is, police operations in marketplaces, on streets, in cities, targeting certain kinds of groups. And this was in the middle 1930s when supposedly all this mass repression wasn't happening, but it was happening within the civil police boards.
So let me ask you to give an example just so we can get the flavor of this. Say it's, 1934 or something, and say I go into a bakery and I steal some bread and I get caught. What's going to happen to me?
One of a couple things, and it would depend.
Probably none of them are going to be very good.
Well, it depended on the particular circumstances. But you could either be arrested and charged. You could be charged in that case with a statutory crime, theft, and you could be sentenced through a regular judicial court, or you could be taken for an administrative police board and sentenced as or tried and sentenced as a socially dangerous element, and that wouldn't require any court procedure or evidence other than someone saying that, yeah, he stole the bread, or you would say, I stole the bread, and you could be sentenced administratively that way. Mm-hmm. It was a much more efficient way for authorities to deal with criminality than through the choked kind of judicial system. And the political police had actually encouraged both civil and political police to use these boards because he thought, Yagoda thought, that the judicial system was too weak and too liberal. Mm-hmm. Now, often what would happen, it wasn't so much that they would get caught stealing a piece of bread, it's that often how people ended up in front of these administrative boards is that when the police and authorities would issue passports in a city, they would mount these sweep operations beforehand. Or even as they distributed the passports, they would use this as a kind of a net to catch, say, ex-kulaks or people without proper documentation who are unemployed, who had no place of residence, and then they could be sentenced through these boards, and they also used it as a quick and efficient way to gather up all sorts of petty criminals without actually having to go through the process of sorting their crimes out, finding the statutes, charging them with the statute, and sending them through the judicial courts. And this was done a lot with prostitutes. So what's interesting is that if you look at statistics on prostitution, like court statistics on prostitution in the mid 1930s, they would say, well, we've eliminated the problem of prostitution. But if you look at the police records of all of the people that were swept up in the course of a month in a city like St. Petersburg or Tver or something like that, and you go through the short profiles of the people who were sentenced, and I found one of these examples, you find all of the sorts these examples of women, for example, who were between the ages of 20 and 35, who had no residence, no place of employment, And they were sentenced as socially dangerous elements. Now, there's nothing in the record that says that those women were prostitutes, but you can imagine that a number of them were being forced to make their living that way. Mm-hmm. And so they could simply be swept up along with people who had stolen bread or other petty crimes, and they didn't have to charge them with a crime. They could simply sentence them as socially dangerous types because they didn't have proper documentation or whatever, and then deport them, send them to camps or colonies or whatever.
Now, you mentioned the passport system.
Right.
We don't have a passport system in the United States, I think, although they ask a lot for our driver's license. I pity the poor person who doesn't have one. So what is the passport system exactly?
Well, you know, John Ashcroft wanted to implement. you may remember that. And when he made that announcement, I thought, oh boy, here we go again. the internal passport system was actually a system that many European countries used at the time and still do. Essentially, it's a document that has your name and your place of residence and other kinds of information on it, and that identifies you. And that internal passport, it's an internal passport, is issued to you on the basis of other proof that you have when you apply for one. Proof that you have of where you live or where you work. And that's what allows you to move around. It's what allows you to gain work. It's also the thing that police can ask for at any time. And of course, this was true in the Soviet Union. And actually, it's still true for example, in France. A policeman can walk up to you, and this is still true in Russia, and it was true in the 1930s. A policeman can walk up to you and ask you for your documents, which is illegal in the United States, even though unless there's suspicion. And so you always had to have your internal passport. And if you didn't, you could be subject at least to a fine or possibly to detention or other kinds of things. And for a time, there was a passport system under the Tsarist regime as well. And for a time in the 1920s, the Soviets did not issue a single passport system because they associated it with Tsarist repression. But beginning in the early 1930s, for a number of reasons, they came to the conclusion that they needed one. And so they implemented a passport system, an internal passport system in the early 1930s that covered mostly urban areas and some rural areas, but not all rural areas. And so therefore, many, many millions of peasants could not travel without, if they were going to travel, they had to have permission of their collective farm chairman or the local Soviet because they did not have internal passports. Mm-hmm. So internal passports was a way of monitoring the urban populations and the movement of populations within the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. So how did the police use the internal passport system to their benefit and that of the regime?
First of all, there, as I say, these passports would have certain information in them, written into them. And actually, I came across the interesting debates in the early 1930s among police officials about what information they should or should not require in those passports. And there are some interesting examples. But essentially what came to be is that your nationality was listed and your social status was listed. And that was key because you could be identified as a worker. You could be identified as a kolkhoznik, or you could be identified as an artisan or by some occupation or by social background. And within the passport system, the police, in their catalogs, supposedly the way the system was supposed to work is that when you applied for your passport, they took all this information, they give you the passport with this information in it. And then the police in their catalog kept information about your, about any crimes that you committed, convictions, where you could or could not live, various kinds of restrictions, various kinds of suspicions. And these could supposedly be cross-checked with other police. So it turned into a system not only of population migration control, but also of mass social surveillance. And then it was on the basis of that that Yagoda believed that they could really begin to tackle the problem of social order. Rather than going around and arresting people for crimes that they had committed, what police supposedly could do was monitor the population through these passports, and by controlling the passports were associated with your place of residence. So wherever you resided, you had to register your passport. And that way police could supposedly identify how many of certain, of what kind of social categories were living in their towns or in their areas, and they could keep an eye on these people if they were under some kind of suspicious category. Mm-hmm. Or on the other hand, when they would say, make a sweep of train stations or trains or markets or squares and surround them and then sort of start collecting all the documents from the people, they could catch the supposed criminals who don't have the documents, who shouldn't be there, who don't have passports or have false passports. They can catch them before they actually commit crimes. Mm-hmm. So this was supposed to be a scientific way of preventive policing and social surveillance within the country.
Let me ask what may seem to be a trivial question, but I think it's important. How did they keep all this information without computers? How did they do it?
I have a long chapter in the book that some people may find boring, but I find fascinating, and it really details exactly what information they kept and how they kept it. They kept they kept all sorts of different kinds of catalogs. The passport catalog was only one, and that was kept by both the civilian police and the political police had access to it. But the political police, as well as the civilian police, had other catalog systems. The passport system was supposed to be sort of the central key system that tied all of the other catalog systems together through cross-referencing. So what they had was in each city, and then there would be passport catalogs and residence catalogs for each city or each town or each region or county. And then in major cities in the provincial areas, there would be passport catalogs that would replicate or that would concentrate all the information from the local catalogs. And then there would be catalogs at the republic level that would replicate the information from the regional level and then again at the central level. What they did was they used cards, essentially, you know, something like a 3x5 or 4x6 card, and they would register the person's name and all the information that would be in the passport, and then there would be notations that they would either write on the back, or supposedly what they were supposed to do was have certain kind of holes that they could punch or corners that they could tear off that would indicate a certain kind of social status or crime. So that then you could lift up the cards and you could take like a long, like thin rod and stick it through all the holes, and you'd come up with all of the the cards in your card catalog that of people who had been convicted for, say, the second time for theft of socialist property. And so they would keep these card catalogs. My view is that they would supposedly look like those old computer punch cards, you know, back in the 1970s.
Yeah.
Maybe not quite as neatly punched with holes, but essentially they would have these kind of cards. And then what happens is that if a person moves, a person is supposed to deregister themselves, that is, at the police station. And then when they go to a new residence, they have to re-register themselves. And the place of new registration sends back a little chit supposedly to the place of previous registration, and it's marked in that catalog. Uh-huh. So that theoretically, anywhere a person with a passport moves, they can be traced. So if you want to find so-and-so, you just follow the thread. You go to the card catalog and you see where the person moved. You contact that police. They say, yeah, the person's here, or the person moved on and they moved to this place. Mm-hmm. But of course, it never worked that well. Mm-hmm. People dropped in and out of the passport system all the time. But that's supposedly what the cards actually look like. And they, as I say, they kept them in literal catalogs that would look like the old library catalogs that we used to use. And the cards look probably a lot like those also.
So these things don't survive? We don't have any examples of them? There's not a cartoteca that's someplace you can look at?
No, not that I know of. I've tried to find some, and I'm trying to remember actually if I think I have seen a photographs of a few of them, but I couldn't reproduce the photographs. Uh-huh. I have actually seen photographs of some of the card catalogs. Uh-huh. And the way I saw those is because in 1945, in June of 1945, that is to say within a couple of weeks after the surrender of the Germans, the Soviet regime considered it important enough that they sent a delegation of police, civil police, and political police to Berlin to see how the Germans had set up their card catalog, citizen registration and card catalog systems. Uh-huh. And they took numerous photographs and sent them back, and then began to copy those using those kind of card catalogs. So I have seen photographs mm-hmm. of those.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of amazing if you think about it. Let's move on to discuss the origins and prosecution of the purges themselves. And when I say the purges, I mean what is sometimes called the Great Terror. This is 1937-1938. Right. Maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about what historians have said about the origins of the purges, why they were started in 37 and then seen through to 38.
Well, first of all, there's not much evidence. There's not much of a paper trail about what were called the mass operations. I should preface this by saying that originally, when people talked about the Great Terror, which I think is a misnomer, but when people talk about that, traditionally talked about that, they thought it encompassed what now seems to be only the tip of the iceberg, which was the purges within the party and the state apparatus and the military and those kinds of state institutions. But the Great Terror, or what I call the Great Purges, and I'll call them the Great Purges from now on, actually encompassed a number of different kinds of operations. So there were the purges within the state institutions, eventually within the police itself. But then there were the so-called mass operations, which people only began to become aware of, I'd say, in the mid-1990s. That is to say, operations that were by far the largest, that were directed against just large segments of the population. And we can sort of talk about what that was and why it may have come about. But before I talk about what people think about the origins, you have to realize what people used to think the Great Purges were and what we now know about them. That there were different operations that were social, ethnic, and also institutional, that went together in 1937-38 to make up what we call, what I call, the Great Purges. As I said at the beginning, there's very little actual evidence of why these came about. Now, I should say actual evidence of why the mass operations came out, because these all were conducted under specific and separate orders. There have been all sorts of theories about first of all, pretty much everyone agrees that that the origins were fairly sudden. If you look at the mass repression of, say, dekulakization of the mass repression of peasants in the early 1930s, there was a very public and a campaign building up to the repressions in an attempt to bring the public into participation in the regime's effort to repress resistant peasants to land nationalization. In 1937, there was almost no warning. There was certainly no real public propaganda campaign that as a preface to the mass operations. They seem to have begun rather suddenly in the summer of 1937. And so a lot of the discussion about the origins of the mass social repressions is fairly speculative. And it's focused on everything from pure irrationality and paranoia to considerations of the fear by the Stalinist regime that, in fact, they might be overthrown by a mass public a movement, especially since by 1937 they had a new constitution and they were going to have elections to a new Supreme Soviet, a new federal Congress. And some historians argue that the Stalinists were so afraid that many people would vote against the regime that they began these mass social operations in order to get rid of people that they felt were going to oppose the regime. And then others have argued that, and there are some other internal issues as well, but I'd say the electoral campaigns are crucial there. Others have argued that the international context was very important. And here I'm thinking in particular of Ilya Kievnyuk, the Russian historian, who at least found some indirect evidence that Stalin's reading of the Spanish Civil War and the fall of Madrid made him frightened of what might happen if the Soviet Union were invaded, which seemed to be a realistic possibility by 1937. Of what might happen if disgruntled groups within the country were to rise up in rebellion should there be an invasion. And so I'd say those are sort of the two main arguments about the origins of the mass operations, whether they were motivated by internal considerations or external considerations. And as I say, the argument probably will go on and on and on. My feeling is that it's obviously a combination of both. But the crucial question, to my mind, the historical question, that a lot of the internal explanations, and I should say one more internal explanation is this argument of social engineering, that Stalin sort of finally decided that it was time to settle all of these questions about, you know, kulaks running around and criminal elements. And so he decided to do that in one big sort of social engineering purge. But the problem to me, the historical problem, is to understand why Stalin decided to handle these various problems the way he did and when he did. Why in the summer of 1937, he suddenly decided to deal with criminal elements, to deal with escaped kulaks and peasants and other supposedly anti-Soviet elements in a sudden, intensive and murderous way, when in fact, up until then, the police had been dealing with these groups in different ways. And then suddenly in 1937, Stalin changed that. And it seems to me that that's the key historical question. And as far as I can tell, the only real plausible, and it's indirect, but the only real plausible argument seems to me to have to do with the international context and with the context of a war scare and the fear of the so-called fifth column uprisings. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some good indications to that effect. Stalin concocted this idea and the political police repeated it. Local party officials repeated it, that What they feared was going to happen was that several dangers were going to come together. There had been the danger of supposedly Trotskyist and anti-Soviet political groups in opposition, and then there had all and their connection with foreign spies and all of that. And then on the other hand, there was a separate issue, this issue of anti-Soviet elements and social order that the police had been dealing with in a different way throughout the 1930s. By the summer of 1937, it's clear Yezhov began talking this way, other people began talking this way, and Stalin, in some of his comments, began to get the idea that what Stalin saw might happen was that those dangers would come together, that the political oppositionists would begin to agitate among the socially disaffected groups to organize mass resistance once an invasion started. And so that, to me, is what kind of holds all of the elements of the purges together, that holds the political purges, the institutional purges, and the mass social purges together. Mm-hmm. It's why they all happen within the same period of time, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. That's my take on it, anyway.
Oh, it's mine too. Now that you said it, no.
Glad you're on board.
Yeah. Granting that the thing we call we are calling the Great Purges are really three or four different things. Mm-hmm. How was the arrest and then dispatch? Let's put it that way of the people involved. How was it handled?
In the mass operations?
Yes.
This is where a lot of the card cataloging came into play. When the Politburo sent out the order that the political police should prepare for mass social purging, they required the local both party and police organs. Within a very short period of time, I mean, they required this within a week or so, to send numbers, that is, numbers of socially dangerous elements to Moscow under certain categories. And they had to do this within a week. And so obviously what they did was they went to their catalogs, and they started counting. In their arrest catalogs, their passport catalogs, their suspicious persons catalogs, their surveillance catalogs, their informant catalogs, and they put these numbers together and they sent them to Moscow. And then this process of negotiation began. Certain leaders within localities wanted to expand the number of categories to get rid of certain groups. Either Stalin or Yezhov, and usually it was Stalin, through Yezhov would say yes or no. But it was largely through going to their catalog system that they accumulated the initial numbers, of people who would be arrested, and either those who would be shot as especially dangerous or those who would be sent to camps or colonies or prisons as less dangerous, but nonetheless dangerous. Mm-hmm. So the answer to your question is that's where the catalog system came in. And that's the basis on which, in the initial phases of the mass operations, that's the basis, I think, on which they made arrests.
Mm-hmm. Are these the – is this the origin of the quotas we hear so much about?
Yes. Yes. There's that evidence, and then there's also anecdotal evidence that in investigations after the fact, after the purges ended, where I should say the civil police were very deeply involved in this. It wasn't just the political police, but the civil police also, especially in urban areas where the mass operations tend to be not of, you know, escaped kulaks or people like that in the countryside, but in the cities it was of socially marginal elements. And so police were told, they went through their catalogs, but they also simply were told, who the hooligans are in your areas. If you've got people that you've written down in a notebook or in a local police office who've been run in for drunkenness or for rowdiness or hooliganism, they would fall into those quotas also. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, these were the origins of the initial quotas.
Mm-hmm. And then once the people were, who actually did the arresting? And once they were arrested, what happened to them?
Well, I think there used to be confusion about that, but I think it is becoming clearer. It sort of depended on where it was. Supposedly, according to the formal instructions, the political police were supposed to be the ones who did the arresting, and the civil police in urban areas as well. And they were supposed to be brought in. They were supposed to be arrested under a charge. They were supposed to be interrogated. They were supposedly to be brought before the troiki, the police, the arrest boards. And these now were special boards, not just the police boards, but the special purge boards. They could actually be brought before either one, either before the mass operational boards or before the police boards that had been operating all through the 1930s, depending on how dangerous they were considered. So they would be brought before those boards. They would be they could say what they wanted to say, and then usually they would be sentenced. But in fact, in certain areas where the quotas weren't high or the police were lazy, they did things. You know, they could do things pretty much the way they were supposed to do it. But in a lot of areas, there was so much pressure that this system became extremely chaotic, to the point where they were under so much pressure to bring in numbers of people and increasing numbers of people that they started simply hauling people in from marketplaces. They didn't have enough trucks, and so they started borrowing trucks from state institutions. They didn't have enough clerical staff to write up the arrest procedures and warrants, and so they brought in school teachers and civil servants, and then the numbers of people built up to be shot so much that they started bringing in the civil police and even party members and sometimes Komsomol members to operate to work in the firing squads, as I say, it became a very chaotic process, and in some places, what they would do, I describe this in the book, that they would actually separate the different elements of the arrest and the whole procedure. It kind of industrialize it in a sense that they would bring in a number of people, simply put them in cells, and then in other places, either in the same building or somewhere else, officers would have lists of names. They would say bring in civil police or other clerical staff, and they would simply write up all these accusations. And they were actually told, you know, don't write the same thing all the time. Vary it a little bit. You know, use different kinds of crimes or conspiracies. And they said and a lot of people were told put a bunch of people together under a single conspiracy. That way you save time and paper. And so these people would do the writing process, and then the troiki would simply pass sentence on people and sign the sentences, even sometimes after groups of people were sent out and shot. So, you know, it's like a division of labor in which one part of the different processes were separate from each other. Mm-hmm. So people who were, for example, brought into the cells may or may not have actually stood in front of a troika. They may or may not have even known what they were being charged with. They might have been sent somewhere, or they might have simply been taken out and shot without knowing why they were being shot or having been interrogated or anything. And interrogation is another thing that I think started to go by the wayside because they simply didn't have enough time mm-hmm. to interrogate all these prisoners. And so often what they would do, if they adhered to the procedure at all, what they would do is they would have prisoners that were actually, you know, working in exchange for staying alive or whatever, extra rations, who were working with the police, who would be in the cells, and they would say to a bunch of people, look, they just need, if you just confess to a conspiracy, they'll let us all go. And so he'd get like a number of people who may not have even known each other or confessed to a conspiracy. And then that would be written down. But as I say, a lot of the time in certain places where they were under a great deal of pressure, they didn't even bother to do that. They simply separated the different processes. Mm-hmm. Now, this I describe in my book. Now there is one other historian who takes issue with this, that it thinks the process was far more orderly. But I'm not sure it was. I think it may have been in certain places, but there were certain areas that were under such intense pressure to fulfill quotas so fast that they simply had no other choice but to engage in this extremely chaotic kind of situation.
Mm-hmm. How were the executions carried out, and who carried them out, and what happened to the bodies?
Usually, there are instructions about that also. At first, many of them were carried out in the courtyard of the prisons or wherever, the warehouses or wherever that they were using for prisons, because the local prison would get too full. And then Yezhov started sending around memos saying they shouldn't do that because often these were within or could be the shots could be heard within the city limits, and it might disturb people. And also it would spread panic among the prisoners. And so what they started doing, they were told often to find remote areas, either in the forest or in some cases they would use actual NKVD land. Either the NKVD, had its own system of farms and things like that. So often there would be like a barracks or a camp or some kind of farm or some kind of ground that the NKVD could control somewhere out of a town, out of a city. And they would take the people there usually at night. I don't know if they actually dug the trenches or didn't dig the trenches, but they would shoot them there and then fill in the trenches. There are a number of these sites that have been excavated. One, a very famous site in a regional area slightly south of Moscow called Butova. There's a book that shows the archaeological excavation. Mm-hmm. And what's sort of grimly interesting is that the Soviets were much more messy about mass executions than the Germans were. They did not generally take the people's clothing. They didn't extract gold. They weren't systematic about looting the bodies. They just simply shot them. And so in the excavation site, one sees pieces of bodies, parts of clothing, pots and pans and other things. They would also use things like, taking groups of prisoners to a bathhouse, supposedly for a bath before deportation, and then surrounding the bathhouse and would fire into it. Who did the executing? Well, certainly the high political police, but I'm convinced also that the civilian police were mobilized into this because they simply didn't have enough political police to carry out all the executions. How widespread, as I say, the civil police were certainly deeply involved in the repressions. How much they were actually used for in the execution squads, I can't really say. They weren't supposed to be used. And there's some evidence that some police commanders tried to get their police officers out of these execution squads. But I think that if you were requisitioned to do it, they did it. Uh-huh. What they thought about it, who knows? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. There are these stories of, for example, the head of the Leningrad political police, who was a high official. He didn't have to mess his hands up with executions, but he did. He personally executed thousands of people. And they would shoot them. Mm-hmm. They would shoot them with pistols, rifles, whatever they had.
Mm-hmm. We're almost out of time, but I want to ask one final question about the book itself, and that is the purges ended in 1938, the Great Purges. Did the repression continue? And if it did continue, was it of a different sort or the same sort? And I'm primarily interested in the period after the war ended to 1953.
Well, the mass social repressions did not continue. Ethnic repressions did. And in fact, they ethnic repressions began in the mid-1930s, escalated through the nationality campaigns of the late 30s, and then in the war became even more extensive. After the war, within the 1939 borders, the regime no longer engaged in the kind of mass social repression that they did in the 1930s, mainly, I think, because they believed that there was no longer a political danger from socially alien groups. So within the 1939 borders, there continued to be mass repression, but it was not mass repression by political police. It was by ordinary police and courts, mainly for issues of a statutory a violation, and especially labor law violation. And millions of people were repressed in that sense. Mm-hmm. But the kind of mass operations of the Great Purges, social operations, did not continue after the war, except in the new territories. Mm-hmm. In the new territories, in the newly occupied territories, they engaged in both political and mass social repression in much the same way, using much the same, almost exactly the same kind of wording as in the orders of the mass purges from the late 1930s. Mm-hmm. So they were very conscious about that. Within the Baltic states, within the western, new western border areas of Ukraine as well, but not inside the 1939 borders.
Well, as I say, we've taken up a lot of your time, and I really appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you, Marshall.
It's a really terrific book, and I hope that people go out and buy it. I was going to say it would make a terrific holiday gift, but maybe you should wait till after the holiday.
Please encourage people to each buy at least 10 copies of their relatives.
Yes, I will. So, yes, go out and buy 10 copies for each of your relatives, 10 copies for each of your relatives. Dave, we have a traditional final question on New Books in History, and it is, what are you working on now? What is your next project?
Well, as Monty Python used to say, now for something completely different. Actually, what I've become interested in short, are Russian and Soviet scientific and other kinds of explorers in Central Asia from about the 1870s through the late 1920s. This takes me into issues of Orientalism, border areas, the construction of identities and ethnic groups. But it also takes me back to some of my graduate work in the sociology of knowledge, because a lot of this exploration, for either colonial or revolutionary or political reasons, had to do with the construction of ethnographic and geographic knowledge and natural scientific knowledge about these areas. And there was a great international competition. And so I'm looking at the Russians, the Americans, the Germans, the French, and the British, and how each of these different groups constructed their images of Central Asia through exploration. It's of a hell of a lot more fun than studying mass repression.
Yeah. Well, but anyway, so it's a small project.
I'm afraid this one's getting out of hand too.
Yeah, I was going to say that's quite a bit. Well, anyway, we've been talking to Dave Shearer today about his terrific book, Policing Stalin Socialism, Repression and Social Order in the Soviet Union, 1924 to 1953. I would like to encourage you to go buy this book because it really is eye-opening. It's terrifically written. It's wonderfully researched. And I really think that there's a lot of I don't like the word revisionist, but there are a lot of things that even if you know a lot about, you think you know a lot about the Soviet Union in the 1920s, 1930s, you should read this book because probably many of the things that you think you know, you don't know. At least that was the case with me. So anyway, thanks, Dave, for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Dave Shearer about his new book, Policing Stalin's Socialism, Repression and Social Order in the Soviet Union, 1924 to 1953. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.